Welcome to Exploring the Well 86. I'm Blake Spurgeon, here with my brother Kurt. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing great. It's good to talk to you, Blake. How's everything going on your end of the world there in Chicago?
It's going great. We're in a heat wave. It's 30 degrees. You know, you can't complain.
Yeah, we're. It's been a little, people have been complaining about the chilly weather here. It's only been like low 70s. So, you know, it's a little different in Southern California.
Wah.
All right, so what do you got to talk about this week?
Well, I think we're going to have a quick episode, and I just want to remind the viewers that if you're ever buying anything on Amazon, feel free to go by our website and give it a little click, because if you buy something through there by clicking on our Amazon link, we get a little portion of the donations, and you're buying the product anyways. So if you'd like to support us, feel free.
Yeah, it's a good way to help out our podcast. And basically how it works is if you click on the Amazon banner, it doesn't cost you any more, but we get a little referral fee essentially. And if you click on that banner and set it as your bookmark for Amazon, then you can help out our podcast every time you buy something and you won't even notice that that it's happening. So we would appreciate the support.
Yes, we would. And so something I wanted to talk about, you know, that goes along with health and everything like that is that we're getting really close to the second eradication of a disease.
Right? Oh, okay, I did see some headlines on this, but I didn't follow up with it. Which disease are they talking about eradicating?
The guinea worm.
Oh, the guinea worm, huh?
Yeah. So back in 1980, right, smallpox was considered to be eradicated, and right. Over the last I don't know exactly how long. But our old president, Jimmy Carter, has been on this eradication campaign where they're pretty much trying to eliminate guinea worm, which is the way that humans get it is by drinking water that has the eggs, and then the eggs, you know, hatch inside your stomach, and the little worms pretty much go inside your body in the intestinal wall and grow, and they can be up to about 80 centimeters in length.
Okay, it's like a parasite.
Pretty much. And right. I think it was something like this last year, there were some, it went from like, you know, 3.5 million cases in 1986 to last year there were 126 cases.
Okay.
So, you know, we're getting pretty close to the second eradication, and that's kind of, you know, really exciting in a way because, you know, you don't eradicate diseases every day.
Well, it shows what you can do if you have a coordinated effort. And you can come up with a, you know, a technique or a method for curing it. I'm not currently in a Rotary Club, but I've been part of the Rotary Foundation and a Rotary Club. And one of the big, you know, triumphs of one of the things that the Rotary Club is very proud of is eliminating smallpox. So, or I think that was the other eradication, wasn't it? Smallpox?
Yeah, 1980.
Yeah, so, you know, they're very proud of the role that they played in eradicating smallpox, and rightfully so. You know, they put a lot of resources, both time and money, and a lot of very smart people who worked really hard to eradicate smallpox. And so it shows that it can be done. It'd be nice if after, you know, this guinea worm disease, if we can get on to eradicating things like AIDS and even malaria would be the big one. I don't know if you've heard that statistic, but I had heard recently that half of all the people that have ever died on this planet have died from malaria.
Wow.
So if you think about every person that's ever died from any cause, half of the people that have died on this planet have died from malaria. So when you look at, you know, devastating diseases, that's about as devastating as you get. So, you know, it's good to see that there are ways to handle these things. So it's, even though guinea worm disease is not something that's doesn't have the popular sort of.
Well, right, you know, but it's still pretty gross. And the funny thing is one of the ways that they did it is there's a pretty much a straw that they've created, which is a tube with a filter in it. And instead of drinking the water, if you drink the water through the straw, you don't get guinea worm. Yeah, and so they've given millions of these to, you know, a lot of places anywhere from Ghana to other Asian and African countries. And it used to be, back in 86, the stat was that it was an endemic disease in 24,000 villages across 21 countries. And to go from 3.5 million cases to 126 in 20 years is quite extraordinary.
Yeah, that's spectacular. Well, I mean, that's fantastic. It's a good sign that we've got, it's sign that the technology's helping, sign that people have been going to work, and sign that public health education.
Right, that's what I was going to say, is you can give people the tools to eradicate it, but if they're not going to drink out of the straw each time because of education and understanding what they're doing, you know, it's not going to solve anything.
Yeah, I mean, that does remind me a bit of the problem they're having with, say, AIDS in Africa, is getting people to use condoms, you know? I mean, it's difficult in the United States, but it's even more difficult over there. So, you know, it's good to hear that education programs like this can, and you know, technology can finally turn the tide, if it would, stem the tide, I guess, and turn the course of these diseases and lead to eradication. That's wonderful.
I agree. So to change topics to something a little more lighthearted, I just thought this isn't really that sciencey, but it's, I mean, when we think about it, it can turn into that. But so there's a dog in Seattle that gets on the bus and goes to the dog park.
Okay.
So it started a couple of years ago, where it's an urbanized dog. He walks on the sidewalk, or she walks on the sidewalk, and you know, with their owner and everything. But, you know, one day, you know, the owner had taken the dog to the dog park so many times. They get on the bus, they go, and he was smoking a cigarette and kind of missed the bus. And the dog jumped on and went off on its own. And ever since then, when the dog kind of wants to go to the dog park, he or she goes over and waits for the bus and gets on the bus and sits just like a person, you know, kind of in the handicapped area. Right. And when it gets off at the right stop, the dog gets off and goes to the dog park and comes back on his way on the normal way. I mean, obviously doesn't pay a fare, but, you know, people know the dog.
Right. And it's great.
It's quite funny. He was saying that he gets calls all the time and is like, "Hey, I have your dog here." And he has to tell him, "No, don't worry. Just let her go. She knows how to get home."
Yeah, should be cool. Don't sweat. It's all good.
Right.
That is fantastic. You know, when it highlights how stupid my dog is. We have a Maltipoo who is super cute. I mean, he's the cutest dog ever. But he would never be able to learn this stuff. He can't fetch. You know, he can barely sit. You know, so you know, it just goes to show you that some of these dogs are pretty. Can be pretty smart. It reminds me, though, have you seen some of the photos of dog breeds and how they've changed over the years? Have you seen any of those photos, or have we talked about that?
No.
There's some really cool, it's really fascinating to see what selective breeding can do with dogs in terms of, and how the certain traits have been sort of emphasized and enhanced or become so much more prominent over the course of, you know, even just 100 years of selective breeding. So if you get a chance, look up dog breeds, 100 years or something like that, and you'll see what, like, a pug used to look like 100 years ago looks very little like a pug looks now. You know
wow,
what I mean?
Really?
Like, it's really wild to see how much they've changed, how much the dog breeds have changed just from this, you know, very selective breeding. And, you know, pretty fascinating stuff.
Is it more puggy? So,
it's way more of what we think of as a pug. In fact, all of the dogs were less distinct from one another, say, 100 years ago. You know what I'm saying? Like,
right.
A pug still looked like a pug, but it retained some of the features that you would associate with other dog breeds.
Okay.
Whereas the selective breeding has sort of emphasized and highlighted the really, you know, weird, the more extreme characteristics of each breed, and made them stand out more from the other breeds. And it just goes to show you how dramatically we as humans can impact how a species looks and behaves and all those things based on selective breeding, basically, you know, genetic pressure, you know, from what we're looking for in an animal. You know, and dogs, of course, are evolved from wolves, all of them. And you know, when you look at my little Maltipoo, and you think that thing is genetically related to a wolf, it's pretty hard to believe, you know. But, you know, cute gets bred for, and the more, you know, cute and dumb apparently is a winning trait when it comes to little dogs. You know what I mean? Because
right,
my
I
wife
mean,
loves the crap out of this dog. You know,
right. I mean, and if you think about when dogs were becoming domesticated originally with wolves, you know, if you're gonna bring a dog into your family and it's gonna help you protect your family, if that wolf at the time, I want to say wolf, attacks a member of your family or something like that, you know, you're going to kill that wolf, and then that wolf's bloodline isn't going to continue on. So the ones that continued on being domesticated were those that were more supple, were more conducive to interacting with humans and didn't have that aggression. And that's, you know, that's cascaded down the line to all the other different breeds.
Absolutely.
Well, not every breed, but most breeds are like that. There's some breeds that are more aggressive, but every time, but actually every time that that's been studied, they found that that's not the case. And that even like the pit bulls and stuff, that they're not more aggressive, that sometimes it's the owners that actually make them more aggressive.
Oh, sure. Well, I think that's sort of that's a situation where you have, you know, the cart before the horse. Sometimes an owner picks a pit bull because it looks scary and then, you know, treats it in such a way that it becomes aggressive and mean. But I also find it really fascinating to look at how certain traits are bred into dogs. For instance, I know how we got on the dog topic, but the point is, like, when you look at, like, I was watching this really amazing hunting show, and they were showing hunters hunting with dogs. It was like a competition of how the dogs could flush pheasants or whatever it was they were hunting. And then retrieve the bird and all these things. And it's really fascinating that these dogs are, you know, some of these dogs like pointer breeds and things like this, or flushing breeds, have just this natural, you know, bred ability.
Well, it's kind of exciting for them in a way, right? I mean, think about if you did it with humans, right? If you bred us for what we'd want to do, right? Certain humans have a design and a want to, like, you know, go out there and run, and some want to sit on the couch, or some want to go discover this, and some, you know, if you bred us to do something like that, we'd become so much more specialized and good at those independent things, but we wouldn't be good at, you know, other things.
Right. Well, I mean, that's the thing. You know, well, I mean, obviously humans are a different thing, but I mean, in some ways that is kind of what happens, because people selectively choose. I mean, if you look at, like, people in general are getting taller, right? And certain traits like, let's say blue eyes, for instance, even though it's a recessive gene, it does get selected for because it's a trait that's attractive, you know, and tends to, in very small amount, let's say, lead to, you know, a higher incidence of maybe procreating, and so that trait gets carried on, you know what I mean, or whatever the trait might be, tall.
Well, interestingly, slim. You know, when you said that, so Americans, we used to be the tallest in the world on average, right? And now we're like 23rd, right? So other countries are growing at a faster rate in terms of height than us.
Well, that I think that's probably more, and I would have to look at the statistics on that, but I think my feeling about that is partly because of the role the United States plays in as the great mixing.
Right. I agree.
The great, you know, we have such an amazing, I mean, one of the things that makes the United States such a rich place to live and such a wonderful place to live is that we have people from all cultures coming here and making their lives here. So,
no, you can't have citizenship. You're under 5 foot.
Right. But I mean, like, you know, so that means a lot of Hispanics, which tend to be shorter, Asians that tend to be shorter. And so, you know, it kind of brings our average down on the average in terms of height. So whereas you look at a place like sort of the Netherlands or something, they tend to be a little bit more homogeneous in terms of the, you know, ethnicities that are immigrating to those areas. So, I mean, in general, these are.
Yeah, I think it was like Sweden or Norway that has the tallest
ones,
height now.
Sure, but I mean, they tend to be, you know, they were already tall to begin with, and they probably have, I would imagine, I'm just speculating, but I would imagine they have a narrower, you know, influx or narrower sort of pool of people that are immigrating there. So, you know, I think that's a big effect. I mean,
well, let's stop speculating and let's move on.
Okay.
So
speculating is part of the fun part of the podcast, maybe the funnest part.
I agree. So, you know how when you look at a map, you always see Africa, and it looks to be about the same size as, like, the United States?
Right. Yeah.
So you look at a map and you're like, oh, Africa's the same size. But actually, right, when you actually do the numbers, the United States, China, India, and all of Europe can fit within the land mass of Africa.
Yeah, I saw this. It sucks that it's virtually impossible to create an African, I should say an accurate representation of the Earth on a flat surface,
Right.
because so we've grown up looking at a flat surface map as opposed to a globe for the most
Right, and
part
it
of the
makes all the northern hemisphere countries or,
look
areas look
huge,
huge.
like
Right.
Canada looks enormous, what I
Well,
mean?
I mean, Canada's not small, but it's not
No,
as big as, other
as it
places.
looks,
Right.
right. Yeah, I mean, Canada is not a small country, but it is much smaller than it looks on a regular flat map, for sure. And Africa has that is looks much smaller than it would normally look. So, well,
Right.
we're also what's weird too, and I've thought about this too, is that we as Americans always look at North America as the center of everything. You know what I mean? North America and Europe. So everything is very North America, Europe centric in terms of the maps that we're looking at. So we tend to downplay the size and importance of some of those other regions in the globe, So like when you look at a map, you always think of North America and Europe as being sort of the central focus of the map, but you could easily represent the map in another way where the Pacific is the sort of central focus with, Russia and China and Canada and Alaska being the central focus, you know what I mean?
Right.
So it's just funny how we get these sort of conventions that we develop over the years, and it really colors how we see the world that we live in.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, and it's quite interesting because you don't think about it until you maybe look at a picture of the Earth from outer space or something like that, and then you really realize the differences.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's the same kind, well, not the same kind of thing, but it's similar when you start to think about the scale of the universe and all those cool videos that show that. We just never think about that stuff in our day-to-day lives. But the reality is, some of the things that we don't think of about in the day our day-to-day lives are some of the more interesting things that we could think about. So anyway.
Yeah. One last thing I wanted to talk about was so we always try to incorporate all these exoplanets and stuff, and it's especially nice having Professor Abel Mendez on a few episodes ago. But so there was a nearby star a couple weeks ago that was found, and it's 150 light years away, and it has an M dwarf star, which is a little cooler, and it has three planets that go. Well, that we've observed that go around it, and we've observed via transit. And we actually used the Kepler telescope, which is kind of a hobbly right now, meaning that it lost one of its rotator wheels, so it's still working, but not as accurate as before. But one of those is in the habitable zone, and it is 1.5 times larger than Earth, and receives 1.4 times the amount of light that Earth does, but only 150 light years away. So really, it's just interesting how many we keep finding. We've found probably somewhere around 1,900 exoplanets, and I think only about 29 of them have been found to be, Earth-like or potentially habitable, I guess you could say. That would be the correct terminology.
Yeah, this reminds me. I don't know if you saw the Fermi paradox thing I posted on Facebook.
Yeah, I always love that.
That there's a it's on waitbutwhy.com if you look up Fermi paradox, and they list a bunch of different possibilities for the Fermi paradox. And which if we want to just review for our listeners, the Fermi paradox is that the
Why have
universe.
we not found them yet?
Right. So the point is that the universe, if you look at the Drake equation, and you look at the size of the universe and the number of stars that are in the universe and the number of potentially habitable planets based on what we're our observations up to this point are, and also the likelihood that life must exist, and also the time scales that we're looking at, then the then there must be, several hundred thousand minimum civilizations or intelligent, civilizations out there of some sort.
Well,
Now,
I think it depends on like what numbers you put there, right?
sure, but I mean, but essentially, the most current estimates is that there's probably on the order of 100,000 or more intelligent civilizations or civilizations that are on par with us or more
Well, I
intelligent,
mean,
right? That's the
if but if you read that whole Fermi paradox thing, I mean, it depends on how you feel, right?
Sure.
What if we are either one of the very few civilizations that have got past a specific point in evolution where
Sure.
you can, most civilizations don't get, or what if that point, I think it was the Great Divider or something is what they called it. What if that divider is ahead of us and we have yet to hit the point at which most civilizations that are intelligent, peter out.
Sure. So this is the paradox, is that if you crunch the numbers, it looks like there should be lots of intelligent civilizations out there, but we haven't had any hard evidence that they actually exist. So what that's called the Fermi paradox. So like you said, there are many possibilities that underlie why it's possible that we these those either those civilizations don't exist and we're vastly overestimating how many advanced civilizations there are. Or they do exist, and we just can't detect them. Or there's a variety of
Right.
different possible
I mean,
explanations.
it's
And
exciting
I
nonetheless. It's exciting for anybody to really look at. And by the way,
ex
this Fermi paradox we did post on our Exploring the Well page a couple weeks back. So if you want to check that out, go to the Facebook.com Exploring the Well page, and it's on there right around I think it was January 15th, 16th is when I posted it.
Absolutely. And what's interesting is that every time we talk, it seems that they're discovering more and more planets that are candidates, at least, for sustaining life. And if that's the case, then the Fermi paradox becomes more and more profound in a sense, because that means the Drake equation leads us to predict that there will be even more potential, civilizations or other
Right.
stars or planets that support life. And so why is it that we can't detect them? So it's a pretty fascinating thing to think about. And I wonder how many people actually sit around thinking about this stuff. Maybe it's just you and me and a few of our listeners, but to me, it's some of the
I
most
think there's more
fascinating
people.
stuff to think about it.
I think there's more people than you think. I think that
Yeah,
I think
probably.
there is. I think some people, in some sense, either. I think there's more people than you think. And another good
Well,
one to check out is Imagining the 10th Dimension. It's on YouTube, and it is another thought provoker about how you could conceptually think about a world that has 10 dimensions. It's in any sense, it is a thought provoker.
have you seen, what are those, are they called Venn diagrams where you have like two circles that overlap, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, so you can imagine a Venn diagram of people that have thought about the Fermi paradox and people that have watched Jersey Shore. And I would venture to guarantee that those do not overlap at all.
And so on that note, I hope everybody has a good week.
Yeah, absolutely. It's great to talk to you, brother. Nice short podcast. Hopefully everybody's enjoying listening to us. Click through our Amazon link, and we'll talk to you next time.
Explore the well.